After a tragic and traumatic week that passed with the Dawson College shootings, so much news has flooded us over the past 48 to 72 hours, and it's stuff that should make us all angry. And we're not going to be finished with the story of the Dawson College shootings. We're going to be talking to the Reverend Darrell Gray later in the hour, but the special service held for Anastasia D'Souza, the student who was killed. Her funeral's tomorrow. There was a special service by the students that was organized yesterday. And as I said last week, particularly during the four-hour program that I did and the night after, they were extraordinary in their courage and character and understanding that these things can't be resolved through more legislation and more regulation, but through their own common humanity. I only wish that today, with the start of Parliament, some of our opposition leaders displayed the character of those students. We're going to be examining some of those questions today and tomorrow because there's so much to examine, it can't all be taken in one day. But today, of course, we had Her Majesty's loyal opposition in the form of the Liberal Party and Mr. Graham and Goodale going on about Afghanistan, of course, a policy and a mission committed to by the Liberal government, committed to, by the way, because the Liberal government dithered so long that the only mission left was Kandahar. It is a tragic situation when the only thing that an opposition can do in a country is oppose and not nearly is oppose rather than proposing. Merely opposing does not meet its duty and certainly undermines the courage of our young men and women over there. And where Afghanistan is going will be determined to a great degree by NATO and its support. And we're going to be talking to Colonel Peter Reynolds, former Director of Public Affairs for NATO at NATO headquarters, but just how NATO reached this decision. There was an urgent crisis of resolve, as it was called, by NATO's chief, Jaap de Hoop Scheffer. And we're going to be examining how that crisis was resolved, and indeed how that crisis of resolve can be fixed in Canada. We're also going to be examining the Arar report today. It's been a damning report, the O'Connor report, how one individual gets caught in a star chamber maze of inexperience on the part of security officials, cover-ups, wrong evidence sent. It's just a horrible story. And we're going to be talking to constitutional lawyer Julius Gray about that. And Julius Gray, as you may remember, was the lawyer for the Adil Sharkawi case, which challenged security certificates. And I just want to say a few words about tomorrow night's show, because there's so much news that we already spread it in tomorrow night. We'll be looking at the rally that was held over the weekend in Toronto, the rally on Darfur that was addressed by Senator Romeo Dallaire, and we're going to have General Louis McKenzie on because there's been quite a controversy over General Dallaire, who criticized the Martin government on its Darfur policy when they refused to call it a genocide, became appointed a senator, then praised the Martin government, and now saying the Harper administration isn't doing enough when the Martin government was doing nothing at all. And I can speak from firsthand experience. We, the Institute, organized one of the first Darfur rallies calling on the Martin administration to label it a genocide. And the then foreign minister, Pierre Pettigrew, said no. So we're going to examine that issue tomorrow night with General Louis McKenzie and Deepak Obray, who is the parliamentary secretary to the Minister of Foreign Affairs, and he's parliamentary secretary for Asia and the Pacific. And we're also going to have George Jonas on, and we're hoping also with Professor Daniel Pipes from Philadelphia, discussing the sad passing of Oriana Fallaci, one of the most courageous defenders of Western values at a time of great cowardice and a time of great lack of resolve. So full plate today and tomorrow. A lot has been thrown at us over the past 72 hours, and not only should it make everybody angry, but it should steal your courage to face these challenges and meet the future with the pride and purpose that this country demands. We'll be back with our first guest right after this. And Montreal, pick your topic tonight. Afghanistan, Arar, the Dawson shootings. We want to hear from you. First, we're going to London, and you're welcome to call in as we talk with Colonel Peter Reynolds, former Chief of Public Affairs for NATO Headquarters, recently Special Advisor to the United Nations Office of Project Services, overseeing the Iraqi elections. Peter, thank you very much for joining us. I know it's cutting into your beauty sleep. But you're so pretty anyway, it doesn't matter.
Thanks, Harold. Good to talk to you.
All right. I'm simple and stupid, Peter. Now, Jaap de Hoop Scheffer, chief of NATO, says the following. Now, I think it was a BBC interview. The military advice is that we need extra forces. These are political decisions, however, and it is up to the politicians in the capitals to do what they promised to do, given that every NATO country have troops in Afghanistan. Now,
that's not quite right.
Well, I'm just quoting him. This is out of a report from Brussels, and these are his words. What I wanted to ask you was this, and you've anticipated me. What goes on at NATO when they make a decision?
Okay. The difficulty is that there are 26 guys who are the ambassadors of their countries sit around the table who have been told by their ministries of defense or their prime ministers or whoever leads their country what they can afford to offer the coalition.
So far, so good.
Some can afford nothing because once the Cold War finished, the Berlin Wall broke down, everybody took their slice of the peace dividend.
Right, but
and
this is
decided to restructure their forces. And
I got that in the macro sense. What I don't understand, and this is a report from David Rennie from the Daily Telegraph, quoting Scheffer. This is what I don't understand. The military says they need extra forces. So one would think that if the military from all the countries are telling their politicians they need extra forces, it would imply that they have the forces to give.
Correct, and some may not. One of the fundamental things that people need to understand is if you commit 20,000 men and women to an operation over the course of a year, that actually affects 60,000 people because people usually go on tours. Do you know what a tour is? We're talking, you know, deploy for 4 months.
Yes.
But you have to train those people.
Well, tours are longer than 4 months, aren't they?
Absolutely. So it could be 6 months. So, but you still have to train the people before they go. That takes a couple of months. And then you have to get the kit off them and all the rest of the things and allow them some holidays and leave and that when they get back. And then while those 20,000 are in place, another 20,000 are being ramped up ready to go. And the previous 20,000 from the previous tour are just getting themselves settled back into their normal other duties.
Okay, so am I hearing from you that this is sort of a case of perhaps the American experience in Iraq where the military guys at the beginning said, almost like kind of like Israel and Lebanon, all the military guys said, you're going to need boots on the ground and you're going to need X. And the politicians came in and they started whittling away at the X and gave them X minus, hoping that they'll do the job and still keep their political face.
To some extent, it's a bit like that because every country will have worked out what it can afford to pay for. You've got to remember, if you're a NATO member, it's like being a member of a tennis club. You've got to pay your fees annually.
But the fees
are
lives of soldiers. If they're going to do a mission right, the deaths are tragic, but at least they should count for something to get the mission right, which is the establishment and solidification of a democratic government in Afghanistan. If there's not enough bodies on the ground, that's not going to happen, and the deaths will be for nothing.
And one of the fundamental things is we all work and live in democracies, and in democracies, politicians run the military forces. At the end of the day, politicians will decide whether they can afford to pay for the bill.
The bill
is people on the ground.
Are the commitments at NATO, in the Afghanistan missions case particularly, now when Scheffer called this a crisis of resolve, was that because the original commitments were made on a yearly basis, or how long were the commitments made for that they have to be renewed now, or is this a special request for more?
Well, that's up to the countries to decide individually, and there are 26 countries that the Secretary General has to go for. He may be the titular head, but he's not actually the head. I mean, he doesn't command anything. He can ask the member countries to cough up. You have to remember, only 85% of the pledges actually made by member countries, and there are only 11 supporting nations in Afghanistan at the moment, have actually been met so far. And who's at the forefront? The Canadians, the Brits, and the Dutch, who are carrying the biggest burden, in the South anyway.
Right. So when the military commander, General James Jones, is an American, comes to NATO and says, we need more troops, is he coming because the plans on the ground required more troops, or because the original plans by the military had asked for more troops and they weren't given?
If the original estimate wasn't actually met, he will return to the table to his political masters in Brussels at regular interval and say, hey, look, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, I haven't yet been given the number of people that I require to do this mission. And the other thing people tend to misperceive is that individual nations make individual rules of engagement for their troops. So the Germans who are currently in the north are prevented from actually going to the bit where the real fighting is going on by parliamentary decision.
Peter Reynolds, please stay with us after this short break, and we're going to ask you about the relevance of NATO given the way it makes decisions today. Montreal will be right back. And we're talking with Peter Reynolds, former Director of Public Affairs for NATO, about the crisis of resolve that Yaptehoop Scheffer, the chief of NATO, has called the recent decision-making process that resulted in. And this is my question to you, Peter. So after all the waltzes and dances, NATO coughed up 2,000 troops. How relevant does that, or irrelevant, does that make NATO going forward?
I don't think it's a question yet. The time that we all sit down and forecast the demise of NATO is not yet upon us. I know tonight that General Jones has actually offered to help out in Darfur in the coming weeks if push comes to shove, because the member nations have shown a willingness to deploy people there. I think one other thing that's putting nations off at the moment is that the fighting is quite intense in Afghanistan, and people are incurring losses. And the humanitarian angle is probably not playing that big at home.
So what are we to learn from this, that we're going into an era where the troops come in only when the peace is to be kept, not when the peace is to be made?
I don't believe so. I think NATO still has the capability to enforce a peace. And it's a peacemaking and peace-building operation at the moment. In fact, it's slightly more intense than that in the south, although there's still quite heavy fighting in the east where the Americans are have heavy numbers.
Well, we'll keep our eye on this situation, and we'll hope that your words of wisdom sink in Brussels or in Mons. Peter Reynolds from London, thank you very much for taking the time to join us.
Great to talk to you, Beryl.
Take care.
Bye.
The questionable practices of everything from government to international organizations, the decision-making, the lack of courage, the lack of ability to bring clarity and conscience and character to events that affect our lives, events that affect liberty and freedom of peoples and individuals, has been brought into stark relief in Canada today, and it has nothing to do with the military. But it has to do with the release of the O'Connor Report on the Maher Arar inquiry. Maher Arar was a Canadian-Syrian citizen, many of you know, who at Kennedy Airport in the United States was taken by security officials, ended up in Syria for a year and a half facing torture. And the report today that came down was damning on Canadian authorities. And here to discuss it with us is constitutional lawyer and perhaps Canada's leading civil libertarian, Julius Gray. Julius, thank you. Welcome.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, and a pleasure to hear that the report, at least, that the judiciary, at least, is completely untainted and unafraid, and said, called a spade a spade.
This is pretty much what you and I have talked for months about, that whatever anybody may think of the war on terror, the home front can't mirror what we're seeking to destroy. And this case seems to have, according to the report of O'Connor, everything went wrong. Cover up, false information, people being used, a man being used as a scapegoat for careerism. Where does one start to analyze this and how to fix it?
Well, it seems to me that what we're faced with is the need to question the basic assumptions. Most people in our society are complacent, believe that the democracy is so firm and so good that our authorities are right, and that all accused people are guilty, and that all the police is full of integrity and justice, and so is the security services.
It's whatever they read in the paper must be true.
Well, exactly. But what you have to do is view this case. It's a warning not only with respect to security and our hysteria about security right now, but also with respect to the ordinary criminal law. What I've been saying for a very long time is that there is a very serious chance of wrongful conviction, that the police, for careerists and other reasons, wants to be able to say, I solved the crime, whether rightly or wrongly.
Even when there was no crime.
Yeah, if you sue the police, 10 of them will come to testify against you, whether they were there or not. The same thing applies to the security services. And sometimes it's in bad faith, but sometimes it's even in good faith, in a very peculiar way. I mean, they actually convince themselves that the guy must be whatever they think he is. But the conclusion is that both in criminal law and in the terrorist witch hunt, we have to remember that there is a very, very large chance of error.
Julius, please hold a thought. We just have to have a short break here, and we'll be right back with you. Thank you. And we're talking about the O'Connor report on the Arar inquiry, which, of course, cleared Maher Arar of any wrongdoing, was viscerally denounced the RCMP procedures. And if we're talking with civil liberties lawyer, constitutional expert, Julius Gray. Julius, of course, you were Adil Sharkawi's lawyer in the security certificate case. What is striking about this report, one is too many. One is too many. But the O'Connor report talks about the case of Abdul al-Malki, which we had occasion to look into at the Institute. Ahmed al-Mati, Muyad Nuruddin. Is there anything besides, of course, what you said earlier, that people put too much faith in security officials, but not all security officials, of course, are bad or
competent? No, of course not.
But is there something here to connect? Is there a Canadian-Syrian connection?
No.
In terms of if Syria makes requests somehow... How is it that all four cases are Syrian cases?
Well, I don't think... I think it has to do with the United States. It's a triangle. But in any event, I think what we've got is not that all security people are bad, nor that Canada has some nefarious connections with rogue states. It's simply that you cannot really rely on police anywhere in the world. They have structural reasons to want to solve things and give answers. You can't rely on these institutions in times of hysteria, because in times of hysteria, they're just as much affected by it as anybody else. Just like during the anti-communist scare in the 50s, you had people, innocent people, accused of all sorts of things, or even people who were communists accused of nefarious intentions which they didn't have.
Have you ever been?
Yeah, all of that. I think the answer is we've got to avoid any shortcuts. In other words, attempts to amend the law to make convictions easier in criminal law is an error. It'll just lead to wrongful convictions, and we know that wrongful convictions are worse than wrongful acquittals. Secondly, we have to avoid things like the security certificate. That's an easy way of applying half-proven or not proven suspicions and putting them in action. It's a terrible thing to do. We've got to insist on the rule of law, on due process, on doubt.
On being able to face your accuser and your accusations?
Absolutely, but also a healthy skepticism. It's not because the head of CSIS or the RCMP says something that it's necessarily so.
True.
It's not, but it's necessarily not so. But we should not take it for granted and merely rely on the democratic nature of our government.
A healthy skepticism is needed to protect our own securities.
And it has to apply not only to the security issue, but to ordinary criminal law, where there is an awful lot of wrongful convictions and people are unaware of it, unaware of the fact that it can happen to any of us in the right circumstances.
Absolutely. You know, and in speaking to security officials, as I've done through the years at all levels, you know, the funny thing that I get from them at medium levels, even at high levels, is that they agree with you about that the secrecy is not what they need to protect a country. What they need is straight field intelligence. So how have you developed this star chamber culture of secrecy, not just with things like security certificates, but things like the communication security establishment, eavesdropping on in some cases, 50% of overseas calls. Where has this culture developed in a country like Canada?
Unfortunately, it's part of the world and part of the atmosphere we're living in. The democracy, the protection of individual rights is less and less.
Is it part in Canada of almost a feckless public that looks toward authority as the giver of all good things, and therefore they cede their individual consequences?
No, but it's part of a profound and not always correct conviction that our system is okay. But I would add something else. When it comes to the issue of all of these things, you really have to beware of the solidarity that members of all groups have with each other. try to get a high school principal to interfere in favor of a student against one of his teachers, even when the student is right. Try to persuade a policeman to go against another policeman. Try to persuade a public servant to go against another public servant.
It's a culture of authority. We're a nation that runs between the
raindrops. But also a culture of a certain type of solidarity, which applies everywhere. It applies to unions. It applies to management. It applies to everywhere.
So in return for $24 and a check from somebody, we are ready to run between the raindrops and dare not to care.
And people do have all sorts of rationalizations for why it has to be done. You know, the people that I've sent out on the field are taking tremendous risks. I've got to stand up for them. Even when they do something, you can't hang them out to dry. And, you know, you can understand that mentality, but it's one of the things that leads to the type of
abuses
and the horrors of Iraq.
Well, Julius Gray, I think we're going to need you particularly and more like you in the years to come. And we thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today.
It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you, Julius.
Bye-bye.
Montreal, we'll be right back. Well, Montreal, we're going from a discussion of one triumph of the human spirit in the courage of Maher Arar to withstand his ordeal. Unearned suffering, we are told, is redemptive. And we can't forget what Montreal has been through the past week. The funeral of Anastasia D'Souza is tomorrow. Yesterday, the students of Dawson held a special service for her, extraordinary service. And Reverend Darrell Gray, our great friend and great activist in Montreal, is with us to discuss it. He was there, and he participated. Darrell, thanks for taking time out tonight to be with us. Darrell?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay.
Yeah. It's always a pleasure speaking to you.
Darrell, you know, last Wednesday night I was asked to do a four-hour show of the day of the shootings and it continued into the next night. The kids just blew me away. I was, you know, I was worried that we'd get all these kind of, you know, requests for more legislation and how can this be fixed. And the ones who got it were the kids. They called dozens of them, one after another, saying, it's about reaching out my hand to the next guy and making them understand that we're all human. It's about being a community. It's not about the engineering degree and the accounting degree. And, Darrell, I could have gone on till midnight last Wednesday night. Did you see that? I mean, that was in evidence yesterday. These are kids who are getting this service together.
Well, listen, the young person, Jeremy Baggett, was a friend of Anastasia's, and he really wanted to do something, first of all, just to remember her and to let people know what kind of person she was, but also to help him get through his grief and a lot of the other students. There were over a dozen students from Dawson that also attended the memorial service, and just, you're absolutely right. The words that they used, they were very clear. You know, I have a philosophy, Beryl, that children are born brilliant and we make them stupid. I think that these children exercised a spark of brilliance. I think that the compassion that they showed, the common sense to all of this. Now, there are people who say, but there's no common sense to this tragedy. We're not talking about the tragedy. We're talking about the aftermath. We're talking about what these young people say. These are the things that can be done to contribute to a better society, to contribute to a peaceful society, that if we simply stop labeling people and looking at the difference in people and look at some of the things that are our common threads, we would have a much more peaceful environment. And this is what these young people really want to portray. And they also said very clear, Beryl, that they weren't there to mourn death, but they were there to celebrate life. Exactly.
And it was that's what struck me, that out of the tragedy and trauma came the triumph of will, the triumph of human spirit. While so many were talking about the root causes, you know, young person after young person, many of them were there, said, what does it matter what the root causes were? She's gone. Our friends are injured. What we got to learn is it doesn't matter that the other guy's different, the other girl's different. Let's talk to the people who think they're different. They understood what you and I grew up with as calling alienation. They understood it intrinsically. And I was so taken with their eloquence and courage. It was something that the psychologists and the sociologists, for 4 days I was looking for one of the talking heads to say, that young people have the right stuff to understand that life is not a dress rehearsal and they're ready for it. I didn't hear them say it, but I heard the kids say it.
Well, these kids, like you say, have been remarkable because nowhere along the line have you heard the words black, white, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, rich, poor. You haven't heard it.
No.
You've heard Dawson students. You've heard Montreal. You've heard these young people, and that's what they're looking at. They've done what we have been unable to do after years of struggle and fighting and clawing to try to make a better society. They're really figuring it out.
And well, one of them said on the air, they said exactly what you just said. They said, it's not about your religion. It's not about your color. We could throw all these rituals away. It's about, and they use this phrase, it's about our common humanity.
Mm. Well, I think, but you're right, but that's where they are.
Out of the mouths of babes.
Sometimes. Well, we've got to be careful, too, and we've got to listen. I did an interview with one of the reporters, and I told him, I said, listen, we better pay attention to what they are saying, and we've got to realize that these young people are not the leaders of tomorrow, they're the leaders of today, and they've got a lot of good ideas, and they want to do something right now, and we're going to have to get out of the way and stop trying to be a bunch of gatekeepers, thinking that these young people don't know what's going on. They do know what's going on, and they want to be part of the solution, because the reality is, I just celebrated a birthday the other day, and you and I are right around that same age. And,
you bet.
And, I mean, our best years, and you may disagree, but most of our best years are behind us.
Nah.
But their best years are truly in front of them, and they know it. And so this is an opportunity for us right now, Beryl. This is an opportunity for this city to try to move past the ugliness of what happened the other day. And, you know, some people say, well, Daryl, don't be too blunt. But, you know, what if it is a wake-up call? What if this, you know, this, my daughter goes to Vanier.
Daryl, sorry, yeah. We just got to take a short break. We'll be right back with you. Hold the thought. And email us your comments after the show at info@iapm.ca. We're talking to the Reverend Daryl Gray, one of Montreal's civic treasures, social activist. Yesterday he participated, ministered at a special service held for murdered student Anastasia D'Souza at the Dawson College shootings. And Daryl, you were telling us before the break that your daughter goes to Vanier.
She goes to Vanier, and she was saying that they've been speaking to CJEP students throughout, not just Dawson, but throughout. And a lot of them were affected, I mean, without question, by this, because the reality is, Beryl, it could have happened at any of our schools, not just the...
And not just at schools.
Exactly.
Random violence is everywhere.
And I think because what is happening, and they're saying it, is that we are working too hard to create a climate of I don't care or you don't count.
Right.
And you're right. That's what the students were saying. Let's move away from that climate. Let's move away from the barriers. Let's move away from the fences. Let's move away from the walls.
They want to engage. They're not afraid of wading into the big muddy and engaging.
But we are.
Yes.
But we are.
That's an incredible thing.
But you're right. But that's why I said
they've got the eyes on the prize without anybody telling them about it.
But then we need to encourage them,
yep.
Beryl. And I think that shows like yours encourages that dialogue. And dialogue or debate or discussion, whatever you want to call it, but it encourages it. And as long as we're talking, then we can hear. And as long as we can hear, then we can make some decisions based upon what we hear. But when we stop talking to each other, we can't hear. We don't know. I don't know your fears. I don't know your pain. I don't know your hurt. And, you know, I'm not trying to make an excuse for what happened, because there is no excuse, but there are reasons. And if we don't start dealing with the reasons, unfortunately, we'll have more violence in the street. And it may not be someone walking into a Dawson College or a Vanier or a supermarket. It still may be the one-on-one on the corner somewhere, on the corner of Atwater and DeLille, a 25-year-old man gunned down in broad daylight. That's the climate. And that's what these young people are saying. We can work to erase this climate. We may not be able to stop it all today, but we can chip away at it.
Yes, my friend. And if you say shows like ours encourage the dialogue, ministries like yours give people the courage to follow through. Reverend Daryl Gray, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Beryl, for what you're doing.
Montreal, tomorrow is the funeral of Anastasia D'Souza, a brilliant young life cut short. The troubled man who killed her, wounded 19 others, said on his website that he wanted to die in a hail of bullets or in a scene from Romeo and Juliet. But that play does not belong in his legacy. That belongs in the legacy of Anastasia. And if there's one piece of comfort that perhaps we can offer her parents as they go into a traumatic day tomorrow, it is this quote. When she shall die, take her and cut her out in little stars, and she will make the face of heaven so fine that all the world will be in love with night and pay no worship to the garish sun. Montreal will be back tomorrow. Thank you to Chris Smith and Master Control. Good night.